Hoop Heads podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hello, Hoop Heads. This is Alan Stein Jr. My new book, Raise Your Game, High Performance Secrets from the Best of the Best, will be available from all major book retailers on January 8th. Raise Your Game takes a rare peek behind the curtain and shows you what the top coaches and players in the game do during the unseen hours. I share their routines, rituals, and habits, as well as proven strategies that you can implement with your team immediately. If you want to maximize your coaching impact and influence, order your copy today at RaiseYourGameBook.com.
So many more girls are playing, and which is just, it's just awesome to see. You know, as a, as now as a college coach and getting out to AU games, you're like, oh my goodness, there's so many people to watch. It's such an amazing thing to see, you know, just how many girls are involved in, and not only basketball, but just all, you know, all sports across the board. And, you know, it just wasn't like that with me growing up, and it's awesome. Love it. So there's so many more, you know, opportunities, you know, there's so many more AAU programs and so many more, you know, skills coaches you can have. And, you know, there was none of that. There really was a couple AAU programs throughout the whole state of Massachusetts that you could be involved in. And to see it now just kind of blow up is just awesome.
Coach Carla Berube is in her 17th season as the head coach at Tufts University. Coach Berube guided Tufts into the NCAA Final Four in four consecutive seasons from 2014 to 2017. Including two straight appearances in the national championship game. During her tenure, the team has received 10 NCAA berths overall and has a 30-12 record in those games. Presented with the Pat Summit Trophy as the 2015 United States Marine Corps Women's Basketball Coaches Association NCAA Division III National Coach of the Year, Coach Berube's teams have compiled a 356-93 overall record for an outstanding 793 winning percentage that ranks 10th among active coaches in Division III. In April of 2017, Berube was selected as the head coach of the USA Basketball Women's Under-16 National Team by the USA Basketball Women's Developmental National Team Committee. She guided the team to a 5-0 record at the International Basketball Federation Americas Championship in Argentina, including a 91-46 win over Canada to win the gold medal. That victory qualified Coach Berube and the team for a berth in the 2018 FIBA U-17 World Cup, which they won this past summer, including a 92-40 victory over France in the final. In 2017 and 18, she was a co-recipient of the USA Basketball Developmental Coach of the Year Award. As a player, she had been a member of the bronze medalist team at the 1994 U.S. Olympic Festival. In the New England Small College Athletic Conference, NESCAC, Coach Berube has guided Tufts to two conference titles and eight league championship games overall. The team has a 47-3 record against league opponents from 2014 to 2018, and an 88-17 record against conference opponents since 2007. Coach Berube is a five-time NESCAC Coach of the Year. A 1997 UConn graduate, Coach Berube was a member of the Huskies' 1995 undefeated NCAA Division I National Championship team. She then played professionally in the American Basketball League before getting into coaching as an assistant at Providence College. She was hired at Tufts in 2002. We need your help in our mission to grow the game of basketball. Please leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to the show. When you do, you'll be helping other members of the basketball community find and connect with the Hoopheads Pod. Grab a pen and paper as you prepare to take some notes while enjoying this episode with Coach Carla Berube from Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts.
Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to have as our guest Carla Berube from Tufts University and the USA Basketball Developmental Coach of the Year for 2018. Carla, welcome to the podcast.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to get you on and have a chance to talk to you about all the varied experiences you've had in the game of basketball. Want to talk at first here about how you got into the game of basketball as a kid and what really attracted you to the game and made you fall in love with it.
Yeah. Well, I come from a family that loves sports, from basketball to baseball, football, big golfers in my family as well. But my dad had played in high school and a little bit. I think the freshman team at a small D3 school in Massachusetts, and I have an older brother, 2 years older than I am, and they put he put a hoop in our driveway on a tree. I was probably maybe 7 years old, and just kind of fell in love with the game. It was something that, you know, I could play by myself, you know, shoot, you know, in the driveway, work on my ball handling. And in that time, you know, 7 years old, 8 years old, started to play in a town league, sort of rec league. I was probably one of two girls in the league. And yeah, just kind of fell in love with the game. I was lucky enough to have not only my brother to play against, but a neighborhood full of boys, not many girls. And so those guys were always up for, you know, a game of 2-on-2, 3-on-3. And yeah, just loved the game, but loved playing. I played soccer, never played softball, but I did track in high school and, you know, just always really, really active, you know, family games of football with the extended family. But I just took to basketball and got involved in AAU pretty early for that sort of era, playing it. I think I was 12 years old. You could play on a 13 and under team and, you know, played middle school and just, yeah, just really, really enjoyed it and, you know, got better. And, you know, when you're beating the boys, then you think, you know, you're pretty good. So,
yep.
And yeah, played varsity in eighth grade and, yeah, you know, played throughout the summer in AAU. And, it was something I enjoyed watching it on TV, watching the Celtics. My mother had gone to UConn. So we'd watch a lot of UConn men's games on TV and, yeah, kind of just love the game. It's, you know, still have it to this day.
How would you say that at what point did you start playing primarily against girls? Cause I'm guessing that, you know, from the time you were 7, like you talked about, you spent a lot of time playing with the boys. So was there a point where was it middle school where you transitioned that AAU experience where you first started to play in an all girls setting?
Yeah. I think that making the middle school team in sixth grade was when I was first playing with just girls. But then I'd always, you know, over the weekend and, you know, evenings, whatnot, I would go out and play with the guys, you know, in the neighborhood and all summer long. And then really transitioned, I think, you know, when I was 12 years old, probably, you know, going into my eighth grade years, you know, just playing AAU and finding other girls that were as, you know, as passionate about it, as committed to the game. And just, it was awesome to have, you know, to find those, you know, not only teammates, but actually friends that I have to this day are my AAU teammates.
Yeah. I think that's gotta be something that, again, as you're growing up there and, you know, having to constantly to search out competition when you're younger, mm-hmm. to just be able to, you know, play against some girls for a change. Did you find that having played with the boys and your brother and in the neighborhood and that kind of thing, did you find that it gave you maybe an advantage of some of the girls that didn't grow up with that particular way of learning the game?
Oh, I'm sure. I think, you know, I played with a toughness. I also was a pretty good just one-on-one player. And that's just those backyard, you know, games, just no, there's no fouls. You're just going at it, you know, and, you know, boys were, you know, as you're 9, 10, 11, 12, they're getting stronger and stronger and you've just got to, you know, stand up to them. And so I've always, you know, thought that toughness I learned, you know, from playing against them, just really helped out my career. You know, thought that defense was a big piece and being able to, you know, just withstand contact too. And, so I think for sure I had an upper hand, heading into high school. you know, with players that didn't have those same experiences I did.
So if you kind of project yourself forward and say you were an eighth grader today or a sixth grader today, how do you think your basketball experience as a female might be different sort of in the system that we have today?
Yeah, it's very different, right?
There's very so many, sure.
I mean, just so many more girls are playing, and which is just, it's just awesome to see. You know, as a college coach and getting out to AU games, you're like, oh my goodness, there's so many people to watch. Like, you know, like it's a lot,
yep.
But it's such an amazing thing to see, you know, just how many girls are involved in, and not only basketball, but just all, you know, all sports across the board. And, you know, it just wasn't like that with me growing up, and it's awesome. Love it. So there's so many more, you know, opportunities. You know, there's so many more AAU programs and so many more, you know, skills coaches you can have. And, you know, there was none of that. There really was a couple AAU programs throughout the whole state of Massachusetts that you could be involved in. And to see it now just kind of blow up is just awesome.
So. Yeah, to go along with that, I think, you know, not only, as you said, with the AAU availability for girls, but also just across all sports, how do you look at being a multi-sport athlete for yourself growing up and playing a bunch of different things in the neighborhood? And then for your players today, how do you look at the multi-sport situation in terms of, do you think it develops better athletes and better basketball players at the level where you're coaching if the kids have played multiple sports growing up?
Yeah, I do. We still find a lot of multi-sport athletes at our level. You know, I mean, there's some that like to just concentrate on just basketball, but I enjoy having multi-sport athletes that are just great athletes all around. I think that, you know, we have a few lacrosse players that played in high school, and you could see just you know, the way they could cut and you know, they use screens in lacrosse, and there's some carryover between the two sports. And you know, I think that sometimes those players don't get burned out, you know, too early, and or, you know, there's different, you know, injuries if you're just pounding the same way all the time, like you would on the hardwood, you know, in basketball. So I enjoy being able to, you know, to coach those multi-sport athletes. We don't see as many multi-sport athletes in college, though. I think that sort of has gone away a bit, at least from when I first started at Tufts. We had several more either, you know, dual sport athletes or three sport athletes. So that they're really just focusing on, you know, on their one sport in college.
Yeah, I think from a college perspective, it's probably pretty hard to
manage
two sports.
It is hard, especially in the, you know, having a winter sport to carry over a fall or even a spring, because our season, you know, knock on wood, usually goes kind of long. It would go into the spring season, and then they wouldn't want to miss the beginning of our season if they're playing a fall sport. So,
yeah, absolutely. If you go back to when you were in high school, and so you make the varsity in eighth grade, at what point do you start to think about playing, you know, playing beyond high school? At what point do you think, hey, I have an opportunity to be a college player? When did that start to sink in and start to become a reality? Or were you not thinking about that? It was just like, I love the guy, I just want to keep playing, and you weren't really thinking about what the end result might be.
Yeah, I think at the beginning I didn't really think of it, and then the letters start coming in. There's maybe my freshman year into my sophomore year, and, you know, just getting the exposure with AAU basketball. And we had a very, really good team. I think we came in fourth one year and second the next 2 years. So we were always on the national stage. And so I just got that exposure. I had, you know, my teammate in college was on my AAU program, Kara Walters. And then, you know, another player went to Stanford. So we had a really, really good team. And so, you know, there were college coaches at a lot of our games. And, you know, so probably my freshman year, you know, into my sophomore year, you know, I thought for sure But my dad always kept me like very grounded. He thought I was going to go to the local community college, and he'd always tell me that. But but you're getting the phone calls by your junior year, you kind of know that, you know, there's that next step.
So then what's the decision-making process look like for you in terms of what you based your decision on, and then ultimately how you ended up choosing UConn?
Yeah. My brother actually was at Stanford when I was midway in high school, and thought that that's where I wanted to go as well. But Coach Vandeveer did not recruit me. So, but you know, a lot of the Big East schools, the old Big East, you know, some ACC. I also looked at Southern Cal and Arizona State. And you know, I had, I want to say like 13 coaches come into our house for home visits. So that way, back then, the home visits, you know, I think they were in like September maybe, and then you went on to the official visits in October or something like that. And so I just, you know, my mom had gone to UConn. It was less than an hour away from my house. Just had a really good relationship with Coach Oriyama and CD and Chris Daly, and kind of always knew that that's where I wanted to be. But I went out and saw some other, you know, schools. And when I went on my visit to UConn and met the team, and, you know, it was Rebecca Lobo and Jen Rosati and, you know, a whole bunch of, you know, really great players. The way that Gino was just selling the program and selling what his vision was, and you know, Gamble Pavilion was only opened for a few years. You know, I'd gone to games there, and to me, it was just like you know, just the perfect place for me. Just knowing that, you know, I felt like he could make me into the player I wanted to be, and in turn, you know, there's opportunities for us to win a national championship. They had made it to one Final Four in 1991. So you kind of knew that you know, something special was brewing. Not quite, you know, 11 national championships later, but
right, but
you knew that you know, that what he was talking about, it really you know, just lured me in.
So you would say probably, if you had to put the number one factor, it was probably Coach Oriyama more than anything else.
Yeah. I guess he and CD together, they're a really great combo, excellent recruiters, and sell their, you know, sell that school. You know, I think the being, you know, closer to home, even though I was looking on the West Coast, I thought that was also a great piece. And then being able to play with, you know, Rebecca Lobo and, you know, some great players. I think all those pieces were important, but I would say he'd probably be the number one, but don't tell him that.
I won't. We won't share.
we'll send this right to him.
Yeah.
Right?
We're going to send that. We're going to send that quote right to him. See if he'll come on with us next.
Yeah.
So what about him made him, during the time that you played there, what about him makes him such a great and successful coach? Obviously the most successful coach, you know, in the women's game, certainly in the last 20 years. And if we, you know, and we could talk a little bit about the rivalry with Pat Summitt in Tennessee, but what makes him so special as a coach?
I just think he knows how to get the most out of each of his players, how he can get us, you know, to play at a really high level all the time, to, you know, to just wipe out any, you know, egos that could be on the team, and just make you better, and make you believe that, you know, and give you that confidence that you are great. But it's almost like he kind of strips you down first, and then, you know, builds you back up, and builds you up to, you know, far beyond what you thought you could be. I for sure knew that he got the most out of me as a player, as a leader, and a teammate. you know, and he makes sure that everybody has a role on the team, and you know your role, and you just want to play that role to the best of your ability. Practices are incredibly intense. You know, you don't want to mess up. And so you're very, very focused, and you learn how to be focused right away. Sometimes it took me a little bit as my freshman year. You know, there's just a huge importance on communication and talking and, you know, just always being loud out there, so your teammates know what you're doing and know where you are, and, you know, great energy on the bench. And, I just think all those, you know, things that I think about every day with my team is, you know, it comes from Gino and the program there. Of course, when I was there, we didn't have like a slew of like unbelievable players like he's had on his team in these past years. You know, just try to strip them of their egos and get them to, you know, just play their roles. You know, and even the players that don't get a lot of time just, you know, love their roles and know how important it is for their success.
So would you say that the secret to the success, much more probably than the X's and O's, which I think especially today, I mean, there's some, obviously X's and O's are important, but I think from talking to the variety of coaches that we've had a chance to talk to, and just from my own experiences, I think a lot of what it comes down to is just that psychology that you described and the ability to build a winning culture. And, you know, everybody does it a little bit differently, but it seems like from what you're saying that you really think that that's been the secret to his success at UConn.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. It's all the behind the scenes stuff. And he, I mean, he's a great X's and O's
right,
coach
absolutely.
Too.
Understood.
You know, just watching him now as a coach and, you know, going into halftime and, you know, just coming back out and seeing the adjustments that he's made and adjustments from when they play Notre Dame the first time of the year and then the second or third, like, I mean, he's just a really great X's and O's coach, but it is, I think, you know, the off the court stuff, that, you know, translates on the court has been, you know, I think he just works magic with that.
And he does
get a lot of really great players there too. So
that certainly helps.
Right. And the recruiting piece. And if, you know, if you look at University of Connecticut, it's a very good school. It's not, you know, it's not Stanford or Duke or, you know, those really, really high academic schools that are also, you know, have great athletics, but he gets, you know, any of the players that he wants, you know, to this little, you know, small town, Storrs, Connecticut, you know, cold, you know, players, Diana Taurasi's coming from, you know, Los Angeles to come and, you know, play, go to college 3,000 miles away.
Slight adjustment in climate.
Yeah. I mean, you just want to play for him and you want to play hard and, you know, he's going to get it done.
Well, and the fan base now from a women's basketball standpoint, I don't think there's a better fan base in the country now. Was it the same way? Well, like when you first got there prior to the 95 season, was the fan base, where was it on the spectrum of compared to where it is today?
Right. It was just on the cusp. But I think that 95 year is when it just went nuts. The whole state just went crazy, you know, having, you know, the coverage that we got, with ESPN in our backyard and, you know, the New York Times were doing articles and, you know, the UConn fan base was probably better then than it is now. You know, at least there was never a seat that was empty in either the Hartford Civic Center or Gamble Pavilion. You know, I think some of the fans have gotten a little too used to winning,
winning
down
winning
there.
Gets a little boring, huh?
Yeah,
well,
I think the other thing, too, though, is the coverage nowadays on TV and everything. I mean, compared to what it was in 95, I'm in Cleveland here, and we could pretty much watch any game we want with whatever package we want. So I think that might play a role, too, you know?
Sure. You don't have to leave your house and get in the cold and get to a game. You can watch it from everywhere. And it's... Yeah, it's amazing how you can watch UConn games from, you know, all over the country. There's so many available. So it's great. it's great. You know, there's so many fans, so many women's basketball fans and you know, in general now. And it's awesome to see all these other programs sort of, you know, stepping up to the challenge. And, you know, Notre Dame winning a, you know, national championship in South Carolina. And it's good. It's great for women's basketball. I mean, yeah, I want to see, I would love to see UConn win every single year, but for, right. For a women's basketball fan, it's awesome to see.
So if we go back to 95, can you share one kind of insider story from that season? Something that was something that kind of encapsulates, you probably have a lot, but something that encapsulates kind of the feel of that team and that season and kind of just, you know, sums up what that experience was like. Cause obviously it was, you know, the kickoff of, you know, the next 20 years of a, you know, a dynasty.
Yeah. I mean, there's always, you know, memories and you know, a lot of memories are from off the court too, just being with my best friends. But you know, the one like game that just sticks out is we played Tennessee in January. It was 1-2. Tennessee's 1, we're 2, and they come to Gamble Pavilion. And you know, it was the first time I'd ever played Tennessee. We'd played Tennessee, and you know, you're just kind of in awe of Pat Summitt and you know, those players and that orange, because you know, I was a women's basketball fan for years, and it's always, and it always been, you know, Tennessee was the, you know, the it team. And and they came to our place and we pulled out a victory, and I think it was on Martin Luther King Day. So it's you know, it's almost now how many years, 20 something years since that day. And we won, and just I feel like the women's basketball in the state of Connecticut just sort of exploded, and all of a sudden we're just like rock stars. and you know, the media requests and all that kind of stuff was just unbelievable. And you know, I'm thinking, and Kara Walters, who was in my class with me, were like, what just happened? I can't believe that we're now, you know, a part of this all. You know, we weren't thinking like this is what we signed up for, but this is just unreal. So that's like just one game. But a lot of like, just, you know, we had gone on a European trip prior to that season. I can't remember who had come in to our practices that August. I know Jim Foster, who's a longtime coach. I think he's still at Chattanooga or just recently retired. But he and Tex Winter had talked with Gino a lot about the triangle offense. And so we put that offense in that summer before that 95 year. So it was the summer of 94. And we were the first women's basketball team to ever put the triangle in, learned all about it. So, you know, great to be hearing it from, you know, Tex Winter, the orchestrator of the Bulls, you know, the Bulls offense. And
so you were Michael Jordan. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, what was I? Probably a little Scottie Pippen. Maybe.
All right, there you go.
It was definitely
not
Michael Jordan. But yeah, and went to Europe and you know, had some great games there, and that kind of just that season sort of just, you know, took off from that trip and the triangle offense, which, you know, having Rebecca Lobo and Kara Walters, Kara being 6'7", Rebecca was 6'4", just having those post players and being able to, you know, just use them and cut off them and dump it into them. You know, it's just the perfect offense for that team. And then, you know, from that point on, a lot of teams had, you know, run the triangle.
So just so you know, yesterday would have been the anniversary of the Tennessee-UConn game.
Okay.
So you're really close. You're 20. So 20 was 20, 24 years ago yesterday.
Yeah. Wow.
Time goes fast, doesn't it?
Feeling old right now.
Yeah. I know. Trust me, it's unbelievable how quick things go.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the, you know, the growing UConn Tennessee rivalry at that time? And obviously they, you know, the two coaches kind of agreed to play that game, and then there was a series that went on after that, and then, you know, obviously you were gone you know, no longer playing, as that rivalry kind of intensified between, you know, between Pat and Geno. So can you talk a little bit about how important that rivalry was to college basketball, to women's college basketball at that time?
Yeah, it was just awesome, right? To, you know, one sort of storied program and one sort of up and coming, you know, Geno with a little chip on his shoulder and, you know, trying to get where Pat has, you know, had been. And for us to, you know, win that game in January, and then we get to see them again in the championship game in 95 at the Target Center in Minneapolis. And again, like, unbelievable game. Our couple of our starters are in foul trouble. And we just persevered, and Jen Rosati had just an unbelievable steal at the end of the game, and ended up winning that game and winning national championship, first national championship. And then we see him the next year, again in the final, this time in the Final Four. They didn't want to put us together in the championship game for some reason, but, and we lose in, we lose in overtime, to Tennessee. And then my senior year, they have the, what's called their Cinderella year, where they had, I don't know, 10 or so losses, and they still make the NCAA tournament, and they get their stuff together, and they end up winning the national championship. They beat us in the Elite Eight. So they're, you know, to me, those were just the best games of my career, the biggest games. You knew those, you know, those two teams were gonna, you know, get after it. And so then I think, you know, Tennessee from where they were, and now where UConn got to, now there becomes sort of an intense recruiting battle, right, for all the best players in the country. And, you know, I don't, you know, I think there was some, just some little bit of bad blood somewhere with, you know, some of the recruiting things, and you know, they stopped playing each other for, you know, for years. But those games were, you know, just some of the greatest. You know, several, you know, national championships were won by beating Tennessee or having to go through Tennessee, but they got us too for a few times. So just a great rivalry, two of the best to ever coach the game, you know, men's or women's basketball. Unfortunate that, you know, Pat couldn't keep on, you know, coaching, because, you know, she definitely would be coaching and would have,
for sure,
you know, so many wins. Just an intense, incredible, you know, coach. And, you know, as a UConn player, you're supposed to, you know, hate that evil empire and, you know, Red Sox, Yankees, UConn, Tennessee, all the same, but you can't help but to just marvel at what she accomplished, and, you know, just the program that she built, and how many, you know, great players she coached, and how, you know, what they, you know, how they feel about her too. And, what an incredible, you know, just role model they were for them, or that she was for them.
Did you ever have a chance to interact with her personally, or talk to, you know, or have a friendship with any of the players from Tennessee that you kind of got, you know, a feel for what she was like, or no, or that wasn't in the cards?
To be honest, I don't think I have one friend that went to Tennessee. And
all right, there you go.
That's
honest.
Choice,
that's honesty, Carla. I like it. I like it.
No, I just, you know, I played a couple years in the ABL, but never had a Tennessee player on a team of mine. So never really got to know any of them. I guess it's for the best, I guess.
God, yeah, probably. totally understand. Yeah. So as you're kind of wrapping up your playing career, did you know that you wanted to get into coaching, or was that something that kind of happened just, you know, by accident, or was that kind of the plan all along? How would you describe your entry into coaching?
Yeah, definitely not the plan all along. I was pretty much an introvert in college and growing up. So never thought that, you know, coaching would be the right, you know, card for me. After college, I played in the ABL. The Hartford had a team called the New England Blizzard. So got to play for a year and a half before the ABL went under. And then after that, I was living in Connecticut and just felt like I needed to just step away from basketball and figure out what I want to do. So I actually moved out to California with a couple friends, lived out there for about a year and really started just missing basketball and knew I wanted to somehow, you know, get involved. And I was living in San Luis Obispo and Cal Poly, which is Cal Poly San Luis Obispo is a D1 program out there. I lived, you know, a couple blocks from the university and went to their head coach and asked if she needed anybody to volunteer. I'd love to, you know, work with her players. I think it was spring. So it was after the season over, you know, spring into the summer. And so I did. I got to do some, you know, individual workout stuff, help them create a summer workout plan and fell in love with it. Got to work their camps. And then I said, I think I caught the bug.
Huh?
I caught the bug. I was like, I think I've got to do this. And looked at some opportunities out west. Nothing panned out. And so I contacted my coaches at UConn, both Gino and I think I talked to Tanya Cardoza, who's now the coach at Temple, that I was interested in if they heard of anything. I wrote a lot of letters to coaches out here because email wasn't that big of a thing
yet.
So I, you know, I think I typed up some letters and sent them out here. And at that time, Providence College needed an assistant coach. So, talked with Jim Jaber, who was the coach at the time, and packed up my bags and came back home after I was out there almost 2 years and was ready to get into coaching. So did that at Providence College for 2 years and really thought, you know, I was just going to work my way up the ladder on Division I. It's all I knew. Just loved it. My first year, and then during my beginning of my second year, a college in my conference now in the NESCAC, one of their job was open, Conn College, and being, you know, from Connecticut, they had contacted me and see if I was interested in applying for their job, and really didn't know anything about Division III, didn't know anything about the NESCAC, and learned about it, and kind of fell in love with the balance. It's much more of a balance of, you know, academics and athletics, and able to be involved in a lot more things on campus, just sort of spoke to me, and knew that, you know, maybe I could be a head coach soon, you know, don't have to, you know, work for someone else and, you know, bring my own ideas to a program. And, but I stayed at Providence for one more year, and then Tufts opened up the next year, and it was just a perfect place, just outside of Boston, you know, in the NESCAC, you know, just a, you know, it's such a, you know, a great high academic university, but could see just what could be accomplished athletically too. It just was a perfect place, and luckily I landed my, you know, first head coaching job and dream job at age, you know, 26. And here I am, you know, almost 17 years later. Pretty happy.
So when you get there, so there you are, right? You found the right place. Stay there for 17 years. It's obviously the right spot for you.
Let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsor, Alan Stein Jr.
Hello, hoop heads. This is Alan Stein Jr. My new book, Raise Your Game, High Performance Secrets from the Best of the Best, will be available from all major book retailers on January 8th. Raise Your Game takes a rare peek behind the curtain and shows you what the top coaches and players in the game do during the unseen hours. I share their routines, rituals, and habits, as well as proven strategies that you can implement with your team immediately. If you want to maximize your coaching impact and influence, order your copy today at RaiseYourGameBook.com.
Registration is now open at www.HeadStartBasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
What, if you go back to that time when you got your first head coaching job, what do you remember from that time in terms of when you walked in the door that first time? What did you think, here's what I've got to do, or here's a couple things I have to do in order to get the program to where I want it to go?
Yeah. Trial and error. Like I really didn't quite know. I definitely leaned on, you know, some coaches, and I know I talked to CD a bit, and Jim Jaber, and you know, just kind of tried to figure out like what I should be doing, what I want to run. But that was all second to, like, here's the culture I want to establish, right? I want to, you know, make sure my players love the game of basketball, enjoy coming to the gym every single day. I want to make sure that, you know, all 12 to 15 players on my team, you know, have a role and enjoy their role and know their role throughout the season. I want them to, you know, to have fun. I want them to, you know, to play really hard. I want them to push past the limits that maybe they've set for themselves. I want them to come together as a team and you know, be unselfish and always look out for each other on the court and off the court. And so those are things like I knew that I needed to, you know, have established right away or as soon as I, you know, I could. And that took some time, just getting the right people in the program too. You know, I think some coaches are lucky. They, you know, they land at a job and it's, you know, they have 13, 14, 15 players that, you know, fit perfectly in what they want to do. Or sometimes it takes a couple years and, to find the right leaders that are, you know, in this for the right reasons. And, I think I was pretty lucky to have a really great group and some really great leaders. And then it was, you know, it took some time to get the basketball players and the athletes that I knew that I wanted to have, that I wanted to coach, which I thought could, you know, to catapult us to, you know, just being more successful. But staying true to all those, you know, intangibles, you know, off the court. And so that's why, you know, that's why I love coaching this level in these, really balanced, really bright, you know, student athletes, students first, but also like they just, you know, they love the game of basketball. They're passionate about it. They're actually, you know, if not, you know, their work ethics could be even, you know, greater than those at the division, you know, division one level. Maybe the athleticism isn't, you know, the same, but it's really great basketball. And, you know, it's just fun coaching them. They're sponges. They want to learn every single day. And, you know, no one's coming in thinking they know everything already. And so it's, yeah, you know, 17 years later, it's, you know, I think I've established a pretty good culture, but it's something that it's always a work in progress. And how can I make this better? And, you know, over 17 years, you know, kids have changed too. And so it's just changing with the times as well. When I first started, I thought I had to be this, you know, this tough, hard ass all the time, you know, and,
right.
And, you know, cause that's what I, you know, I knew. And
for
I
sure.
Just,
that's what you experienced.
Yeah. And just had to reel that back a little bit, just having conversations with, you know, other coaches at Tufts, like, you know, double sessions probably is not the best thing when they have a really tough academic schedule during the day. And so just trying to find, you know, my niche and, you know, Tufts niche and, you know, like I said, it's still always a work in progress and always, you know, wanting to learn more, you know, and bringing in new assistant coaches too, to learn from as well is always, you know, for me, a breath of fresh air too.
So where did you get your staff when you first came? And then to go along with that, how big of an adjustment was it? Because obviously all your experience, both from a playing standpoint and then your coaching, and I'm sure most of the players you had been around since the time you were, you know, in high school, you're playing with high level players, you're coaching high level players. And now suddenly you find yourself at a Division III school where obviously the level of play is different than what you had experienced as a player and a coach. So how big of an adjustment was that for you? And then how did you go about putting together your staff there in the early years, you know, at Tufts?
Yeah, I mean, I had some friends that were coaches, just put some feelers out there. But I think both of my first two assistants just contacted me, you know, once they heard one was living in the town and she had played at UVM and wanted to get back into coaching. And then another had played at Amherst College, which is one of our rivals. And she was living in the area. That's the nice thing about being in the Boston area. There's so many just former student athletes that just want to help out and be, you know, still a part of it. So they both contacted me and, you know, just did some, you know, just did, you know, got out there and talked to some people who knew them to see if they were a good fit and good people. And that first staff, and I think my first couple staffs were great. And then it's been fun to have over the years now, having my former players that play for me want to stay on and be, you know, be maybe a grad assistant for a couple years and then coach and getting the coaching bug, which, you know, it excites me that, you know, that I had a part in that, you know, they love coaching, you know, that maybe playing for me had something to do, with that. What was the other part of that?
Just the adjustment from D1 to D3, kind of, you know, kind of shifting your mindset in terms of evaluating players and just the different ways that the pro, obviously the levels are different.
Right. Yeah. Again, it took a little time. My own just coaching and how, you know, just how, you know, not as hard, not as tough. They really, you know, I think needed a positive role model, for a coach and someone that they could relate to, someone they could trust, someone they could just get to know. And I think when you do that, then they trust you and then you can push them a little bit harder and harder. And so it seemed like, you know, those first three to five years, they really took to that. And then, right, bringing in, you know, better athletes and better basketball players, you know, it took me a while to figure out who those, you know, those student athletes were when I'm at AAU tournaments and elite camps. And, you know, you got to make sure you're not watching just anyone because of the academic standards. You got to know that, you know, those are good students first before you spend too much
before
time.
Right, exactly.
You don't want to waste your time. So, you know, figuring out this, the academic piece and, you know, just getting out there and getting to know a lot of AAU coaches and AAU coaches that typically have, you know, high academic kids on their team. And sort of figured it out by now where I should be,
right.
Where I should be watching. So yeah, but it does take a little while, no matter what. I think if you just jump in and you're successful right away, there's going to be some bumps at, you know, at some point. It's good that I had my bumps kind of early and then was able to take off from there.
So if you had to say one of the ways that you've grown as a coach from your first year to where you are now, what's one thing or a couple things maybe that you feel like you're far better at today than maybe you were when you walked in the door on day one 17 years ago?
I think I'm a lot softer, a little bit less stressed. I think I've let my players get to know me and me get to know them better, just more open. And I think that's just has helped a lot with just morale and with just, you know, them getting to, you know, trust me. And, you know, I think after some of my players think it was since I have had children that I've just, I've softened me up now that I know that, you know, all my players, they have moms and they're, you know, they're kids of someone. So it's good to just, you know, be
a different perspective for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Be on the softer side. But I'm still tough and want the best for them and know how to, you know, get that out of them. You know, we're just today we're working on our defense, and you know, I just want, you know, I want every possession to be perfect, and we'll just keep on working to let these possessions look perfect. And I know that's not gonna, you know, always happen, but let's keep striving for that. And I just don't want to let up. And you know, it's okay to, you know, let your player go by, and our help defender is not there. We're gonna keep doing this and keep working on it. And so I think I'm the same way coaching like that, but just a little bit like, I just think a little bit softer.
Yeah, understood. If you had to talk about how you go about, I guess the right word, team building, how do you go about building the camaraderie amongst the girls on your team? Is there anything specific that you do, or is it more of an ongoing day-to-day process, or do you have some specific things that you every year go into the, you know, you go into the season thinking these are some things we're going to try to do to really build up, you know, to build up the team feeling?
Yeah. Well, I think that a big thing with us is leadership and cultivating leaders, early on in their careers. We do some, John Gordon stuff, you know, just, you know, making sure that they understand that they don't have to be followers for 3 years and then all of a sudden they're like a senior and now they have to be a leader. Like you can be leaders throughout your, you know, throughout your career, and what does that look like, and but how to be also good teammates. So we do small group, sometimes we break up freshmen together, and meetings of with just sophomores with juniors, and talking about what they, you know, what they want for their careers. You know, we have a lot of individual meetings to talk about, you know, individual goals, team goals, what's going on with their academic careers. And I think I've just been really, really lucky that we've had really great players and people that understand how important just team camaraderie is. So they do a lot of stuff off the court that's, you know, non-basketball, hanging out. But there's been years where I've sort of had to, you know, cultivate that, foster that a little bit. And we've been really, really tight for the last 6, 7, 8 years. You know, I haven't had to do too much of that because of, I think, the leadership we've had. You know, they know how to just bring in the freshmen right away, you know, help them basketball wise, but help them with what, you know, courses they should be taking, help them, you know, get settled into their dorms, so that they feel a big part of our program right away. You know, and just always checking out on, you know, for each other, checking in on each other. So it's been really great. You know, we've just been lucky in that regard.
Yeah, I think when you hear about successful teams, there's the saying out there that player-led teams are more successful than coach-led teams. And I think that's kind of what you're describing, that if the players can take over some of those duties that maybe you might have had to do in the first 3 or 4 years of – you know, the classes and the, you know, this is the way we do things. And now it's coming from your players who have been part of the program. I think that A, probably makes your job easier, and B, it just continues to cultivate the right culture that, you know, if the players are enforcing that or instilling it in other players, you know, you've gone a long way toward establishing the type of team that you want to have.
Right. No, I've been really lucky, and it just snowballs, you know, and the great leaders that may be graduating, well, they've shown them the way. This is how we do it here. And yeah, and it just keeps rolling. So I'm just going to knock on some wood, because keep that going.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about maybe season to season, meaning summer, winter, spring, fall, kind of what your daily routine is like during the season, during the off season, just so people can have an idea of what the responsibilities are of a coach at your level at Tufts University?
Sure. We'll say the fall is pretty ramped up. You know, they're in preseason, which in Division III, you know, you can't do anything outside of the traditional the season with your players. So there's no individual workouts.
How hard is that for you?
I mean, well, it's been 17 years now,
right,
so I'm used to it.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, I wish, I mean, so much that I could, you know, be working with them, but you know, can't do it. But they're very, very committed. And so we talk about what they can be working on. And they, you know, they hold each other accountable. They're in the gym on their off hours, not even their, you know, their preseason sort of practice time. And so it's been great, because they really do want to get better and want us to be successful. And so, yeah, they, in the preseason, you know, I'm there, you know, typically 6 days a week. I'm also the home contest manager for women's soccer. So I'm at, you know, every one of their home games. So at the Division III level, you sometimes wear other hats. I also teach a weight training class. So it's a beginning weight training class. So some, not, you know, students that have never really been in the weight room, help them out with some programs. And, you know, my players are lifting their, you know, 3 days a week. They're playing 4 days a week. They're in that time. They do a jump training program, which helps in the prevention of ACLs, ACL tears, and sprint workouts. So it's, you know, they're very, very committed outside of the season. Our start date is November 1st. So there's a good 2 months. They come back to school, you know, they have preseason, and then the NESCAC, our conference, we start November 1st. And so we only have sometimes 11 or 12 practices before we play our first games, which is not a lot of time for college, you know, teams. It sounds okay for high school, but it's not a lot of time.
And it's not a lot of time to get everything in. That's
for yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So that's why we're still putting in stuff now. So that sort of schedule goes throughout the first semester. And then in Division III, you, at least in the NESCAC, once finals start or reading period, we don't do anything as a team. Practices stop, games stop, and then we don't have another game until they get back from winter break, which is sometimes at the end of December, early January. So there's a 2.5 week period that we don't have practice, we don't have games. It's almost like two separate seasons. But we're in the gym doing individual workouts at that time, you know, scheduled around their exams, or get them in before they leave for, you know, for home, for the holiday. And we get back together. This year we went to Florida for a tournament, got out of the cold and enjoyed that trip. And then the season, hopefully it goes through till mid-March is when our Final Four is. And then the season that ends, and that's it for, you know, being with the team on the court. You know, they'll take a couple weeks off and get back to lifting and playing towards the end of the second semester. In the summer, you know, we have a couple elite camps at Tufts, good ways to to recruit. So we invite, anybody can come, but we invite some of our top recruits to those camps. I recruit at a couple spring events, pretty local, and then also go in July to some of the bigger AU tournaments in Chicago and DC, and Atlanta is another one. But the summer is also a time to, you know, be with family as well. You know, Division III is a really nice balance. You know, there's, you know, my athletic director is not, you know, keeping track of when I'm in the office or when I'm not in the office. You know, get what you need to get done wherever you are. And that's, you know, it's been nice to have that and be able to do USA basketball these last two summers. And, you know, I didn't get a lot of recruiting done. Good thing I have good assistants that help me, but to have that experience. So, the summer is a little bit, August is pretty, chill, which is nice. A lot of family time before it all gets ramped up in September again. So that's what it kind of,
nice.
Yeah. Schedule is like, you know, there, awesome. I would say like April, May is some AAU, events. And then of course the teaching I do usually, at Tufts and also individual meetings, but nothing on the court outside of the season is tough because you just wish you could, you know, help them more than what you can do in the season.
Absolutely. So let's jump from Tufts. Let's jump to your USA basketball experience and talk a little bit about how you first got connected with USA basketball and then what are some of the opportunities that you've had over the past couple of years to work with players within the USA basketball program.
Yeah. So this spring of 2016, Carol Callen, who's the women's national team director, had contacted me and asked me if I wanted to be a court coach at the trials of the under 17 national team trials. And I knew of USA basketball because of the Olympic teams, but I really didn't know much about, you know, the younger teams, the developmental, program, anything like that. And so tell me a little bit more about this. At the time, the Wash U coach, who's Nancy Faye, who's now at Illinois, was going to be running the trials. And so I got to talk to her. Wash U is a storied program in Division III. And she told me a little bit about it. And I said, wow, okay. Now I feel really, really honored, to have been, you know, asked to do this. So I said, absolutely. And went out to the trials. That's Memorial Day week. It's always on Memorial Day weekend. And was able to, be a court coach and help them. The trials for the girls' side is much different than the boys' side. They invite, 35 invitees, and then another 120. Come as applicant athletes. So it's this huge trials.
That's a huge number to pair
down.
Yeah,
it really is. It's tough on the committee. There's like two sessions. There's two groups. So two sessions for each session. So it's a lot of basketball in those days during trials. But it was just an unbelievable experience. Loved it. Got to learn so much from Carol Callen. She's been the national team director for a really long time. So the stories she has and, you know, talking about the UConn players that she's had through the years on the Olympic teams. It was just fun picking her brain and just also learning from the other coaches at the trials and Nancy Faye. And it was an awesome experience. And then, done after that trials, and then that next winter, Carol Callan had asked me to be on the next committee for the next, it's like a 4-year cycle. And I said, absolutely, I'd love to be on the committee. So I was all set to be on the committee, and Nancy Faye was going to be the head coach of the team. And then she ended up taking the Illinois job. And so you can't, you know, you can't be a Division I coach and be the developmental coach. You can only be a high school coach, you know, D3 coach, D2 coach, NEA coach, junior college coach. So they were in need of a coach. So
there you go.
Yeah, there's my opportunity. And, you know, Carol and the committee, you know, asked if I would do it, and I said, wow. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to. Yeah. And she told me, and I knew who my assistants would be. And I thought, this is going to be just an awesome experience. Having Vanessa Nygaard, who is the Windward girls basketball coach out in LA. They've won several, you know, California state championships. She played at Stanford. She played in the WNBA. She was a WNBA assistant. Like, I mean, what kind of, you know, unbelievable experiences, you know, she's had. And then the other assistant was Steve Gomez, who's the Lubbock Christian D2 head coach, won the national championship a couple of years ago. Got to know him he was on the same staff of trials coaches that I was on. And, you know, I just jumped at it and was just so excited and honored, you know, to take on this challenge and opportunity.
And so what was that experience when you actually get out there and get a chance to coach some of the best players in the country? How was that experience? What were some of the challenges? What were the challenges, and what were some of the great parts of getting that opportunity?
Well, when the team was finally, you know, selected. So the next year I was sort of the lead clinician of the whole trial. So went through all of that, and then we went right into training camp, and then our trip to Argentina for the FIBA Americas. So it was sort of just like a whirlwind, you know, quickly try to get this team together, you know, first chosen, then get them together, get them to get to know each other, sort of, you know, take away any, you know, egos, you know, their own, this is under 16 team. So, you know, the oldest kids are, you know, 15, maybe just turning 16. I had never coached high school ever. You know, I'm a college coach. I don't, you know, and so that was a nice thing, having, you know, Vanessa on my staff, because she's a high school coach. You know, just learning how to deal with girls, you know, and just getting them to, you know, to play for each other and play for, you know, USA basketball, which they had never done before. And, you know, there was one player who had made the team the previous year, so she had some experience. But, you know, just get them to strip away sort of who they think they are, what kind of player they think they are, and, you know, try to put them in the best positions to be successful. And they were awesome. They were such, it was such a great group. Came together so quickly off the court. We did a lot of off the court stuff with them, how to get, you know, them getting to know each other, us getting to know them. You know, we had some sessions about, you know, that year we, you know, they came in, we had a meeting, and they brought a picture of their family. And so we got to know a little bit about, you know, who their parents are, their family, who means so much to them. You know, just getting to know each other. We did a lot of, you know, icebreaker, you know, team building activities. And then, you know, when he got to the court, they're just so good. They're so unbelievably just gifted, and very, very unselfish. Just, I mean, that, I think that was the biggest, you know, surprise to me, was just how much they wanted to make plays for each other. And got them to play some defense. A lot of new, you know, talked about, like, you know, the terminology that they need to know. So we had like a sort of a whiteboard X's and O's session with them. A lot of them was, you know, brand new to them. It was fun to know, figure out what they need to know so that we could teach them what we want them to know. And then we went down to Argentina and just had a great tournament. Played really well and won the gold for, the FIBA Americas that year. And then, so this is a 2-year cycle. So you're for the women's side. And so, was able to, have the same opportunity the following year for the under 17s, but that becomes the World Cup, right? So now we're going over to Europe
and throwing in a couple more continents.
Yeah, throwing against the world. And the team previous to ours, the under 16, under 17 of the last group had won gold. So felt a little bit of pressure. To do that, but felt good about it and felt good about the team. A lot of the nucleus came back. 8 out of 12 came back from the previous year for the under 17 team. And again, it was just an awesome group. We made the team in May, but we didn't go to Belarus until July. So they had a whole month off to go home. And they worked really hard. They came back in awesome shape. They didn't forget what we were working on. And we just hit the ground running and played some games in Washington, D.C. Saw the nation's capital and talked to them about, what it means to be an American and, what people did before us. And then went into Latvia for a pre-tournament tournament. Did really, really well there, and then went to Belarus for the World Cup, and the team was just locked in, we enjoyed every minute of it. They were so close, and then they just played for each other and played for USA, and I think we averaged like 30 to 40 point margin of victory every game. This is an incredible experience being a part of USA basketball. It's just a world-class organization, from Jim Tooley on down. It was just an honor to be a part of them. My staff was amazing. The team was amazing. The support staff was awesome. And it was lucky that I will always have that that experience.
So I have a few follow-up questions for you on that. Sure. One is, how cool was the travel piece of it for those girls that are that age? Because obviously, they haven't traveled to the places that you guys got to go to. So what was that experience like off the court in terms of their ability to sort of feel the culture of the places that you guys were able to travel to?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely a piece, especially in Argentina. Sometimes some of those girls had never been out of the country. I think maybe one hadn't even been in a plane before she went out to Colorado. And so it was fun to see them experience a different culture, but also, how do you experience a different culture? And being thankful for everything that the people there are, giving us the food, even though it might not be something we typically eat, but you eat it and you thank them. And so that, there was definitely some learning experiences but it's fun to, it's fun to see them, see a new country and see what else is out there exchanging different money and, just the little things. It's fun that they'll, always have this team that they were on. And I know that they're still really close and I'm sure they'll be close for a long time. And hopefully some of them just keep on moving up. There's some unbelievable talent, on the team that I think could keep on playing within USA basketball. It was awesome. We got to swim in the Baltic Sea, right? Like, when would that ever happen?
Very cool. Yeah.
In Latvia, and it was amazing. It was fun to watch them experience it as well.
What was it like to hear the anthem and get the gold medal?
Yeah, amazing. amazing. I remember when we won in Argentina, was awesome. And all they wanted was to eat at McDonald's after we won. So, you know, I have these great memories of them, you know, belting out our national anthem as we're walking down the street of Buenos Aires and, you know, singing our national anthem en route to, you know, McDonald's French fries. And,
that's awesome.
Yeah, whatever.
Are the French fries as good there as they are here? That's the question.
Yeah, pretty good. I thought, yeah, even I had
that's awesome.
Some McDonald's.
That's very cool.
Pretty healthy. But yeah, cool. I mean, when we won the World Cup was just awesome, because that, you know, to beat France the way we did, we knew they were going to be a really, really great team. A lot of them are, those French players are already playing professionally at a pretty young age. And we just crushed them. And then, you know, got to hear our anthem on the podium. And it was fun to see, you know, the players are so locked in, so dialed in, and sitting in the stands are, you know, Don Staley and, you know, every, you know, college coach that is, you know, wants them on their team. And I just felt like they didn't even care who was in the stands. It was all about, you know, our team and, you know, in USA basketball. So
yeah, that's awesome.
Pretty cool.
That's very, very cool. So what's next for you with USA basketball?
That, as of right now, that's it. That was my 2-year experience. I said to Carol, if she ever needs me to help with, you know, trials down the road or being on a committee but it's different. You know, Coach Showalter has been doing this for a long time, because that's how they do it on their side. But on our side, it's just a 2-year commitment, and then they bring in another gotcha. Staff.
Okay. Will they ever ask people back after the 2 years, or is it just 2 years and then you're done?
That's what's happened. But I don't know if they have rules. but you know, it's taken away a little bit of my job at Tufts. I don't think it's something that I could do, you know, every year. Yeah. I wasn't out the whole month of July, which is, you know, the biggest, you know, recruiting period. For colleges.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Carla, this has been fantastic. We can't thank you enough for jumping on. Before we get out of here, if you wouldn't mind sharing out your contact information so people who have listened to the podcast want to get in touch with you. And then if there's anything else that we didn't hit on that you want to share kind of as your parting shot, go ahead and do that now.
Well, I'm not prepared for any.
You don't have to have one. You don't have to have one. There was something else to hit on that you wanted to share.
I think you guys went through my whole my entire basketball career.
We did well then. Good.
Yeah, you did great. If anyone, you know, feel free to contact me at Tufts University outside of Boston. My email is Carla, Carla.Berube, Berube, at Tufts, Tufts.edu. My office is 617-627-5491. So if anybody has any questions or wants to reach out, feel free. You know, I love to share whatever I have. And in turn, I'm always, you know, up for learning as well and hearing new things about our awesome game. So
yeah, thank you. We agree wholeheartedly. It's been a pleasure to have you on. We really enjoyed the conversation tonight. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Hello, Hoopheads. This is Alan Stein Jr. My new book, Raise Your Game: High Performance Secrets from the Best of the Best, will be available from all major book retailers on January 8th. Raise Your Game takes a rare peek behind the curtain and shows you what the top coaches and players in the game do during the unseen hours. I share their routines, rituals, and habits, as well as proven strategies that you can implement with your team immediately. If you want to maximize your coaching impact and influence, order your copy today at RaiseYourGameBook.com.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position,
Training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our Academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, brought to you by Head Start Basketball.